The printed sheet says this is a meditation on what is called the 3 degrees of generosity. So the way the spiritual exercises work is after Ignatius presents to us God's love in his creation for us, and he spends multiple meditations talking about all the things he has given us. There's another meditation he would normally give that I didn't do this time on our relationship with what Ignatius calls creatures. Now, creatures don't mean little cute furry things necessarily. In Ignatius's mind, there are two kinds of beings, God and everything else. So if you're not God, you're a creature because you are created. Therefore, that meditation talks about kind of what is the function of all the different things God has created for us, and what should our relationship with them be. And kind of between the mysteries of Jesus's life, which at this stage we would have already started entering into, between the meditations on sin, through the mysteries of Jesus's life, and before the Passion, Ignatius has three kind of special meditations that he made up by himself. One famous one is called the Two Standards, or the Two Flags, the idea that the world is a battlefield. And everyone here saw the movie Narnia. I think the best depiction of Ignatius's two standards was the final battle in Narnia. You've got one army over here and another army over here, and one is, you know, full of good, noble, wonderful people, and the other shows Satan and his minions, and he goes into what all their schemes are through trying to seduce people with a desire for riches, for honors, for pleasures, and whatnot. And then the army of Christ following him, who is, you know, humble and obedient and whatnot. And Ignatius does everything he can to paint the picture like the bad Narnia army, you know, just so you see these two armies going at each other. Which one do you want to be in? With the guarantee that Christ is already going to win. So what is the logical choice? You want to be with the winner or the loser? Do you want to be with the one who wants to enslave you and torture you, or the one who wants to raise you up and honor you and lead you into heaven? It's like he paints the starkest picture he possibly can to make it real easy. It's like, these are your options, guys. And the reality is, that is what we live in. That is the world that we live in, okay? There's another one which is similar. He talks about the eternal and temporal king, and the ideas again. There's this one wise, perfect king, and who, you know, back in the 1600s, who wouldn't want to serve such a king? The third one is the one we're going to do right now, a meditation on the 3 degrees of generosity. This one is not so much a parable as it is just kind of more an ideas meditation, but I chose a gospel passage to kind of go along with it and illustrate it. Now, the 3 degrees of generosity, as Ignatius refers to them, as 3 degrees of humility. In RC circles, our founder kind of switched it up and referred to it as degrees of generosity. Either one works, okay? So if you prefer 3 degrees of humility, go for it. The 3 degrees come down to this. In our living of the spiritual life, at the very beginning of our spiritual life, before we choose to live a spiritual life, we pretty much live like pagans, right? And a lot of baptized Catholics out there, frankly, live essentially like pagans. We may go to Mass periodically, we may pay to send our kids to Catholic schools or whatever, but when push comes to shove, we live just like everybody else. I'll give you, for example, rates of divorce among Catholics is exactly the same as rates of divorce amongst non-Catholics. I believe rates of abortion among Catholics is probably pretty similar to rates of abortion amongst non-Catholics. Rates of, you know, percentage of Catholics that go to Mass is very low. Percentage of Catholics that, you know, do anything that requires difficulty or choosing the difficult thing in the face of, you know, you've got two choices here. Do you want to do the easy thing or the hard thing? The right thing or the wrong thing, usually most Catholics go for the easy thing. What does that say? It says that we're still living, we may have sacraments, but we have not yet encountered conversion when we're living that lifestyle. The first stage of generosity is when we choose to start consciously living the commandments. Okay, I want to start living the moral law. Not, I'm not just Catholic because I was baptized and mom and dad made me Catholic, and I more or less occasionally go to, I have some of the trappings. But when I choose consciously, I want to start letting the faith change my life. I want to start letting the faith change my behavior, which means I'm going to start changing my criteria and no longer follow the criteria of the world, but I want to follow, starting with the Ten Commandments, and do my best to start living a decent moral life. This corresponds to when we start what I mentioned earlier, the purgative stage of the spiritual life. I mentioned a couple of times already during the retreat, the classic three stages of the spiritual life. You could talk about the pre-stages, like not even spiritual at all, but when we start trying to get holy, the first stage is you need to get purified. That's the purgative stage, right? And that is when you start, you've got all these attachments to things. Some of them are sinful, some of them are not necessarily sinful. But if you are attached to anything at all, if it prevents you from obeying God, then it's a problem. Okay? I'll give you a stupid example. Cheesecake. I mentioned it earlier. I don't know why I keep throwing out cheesecake. I mean, I think they don't even care about it that much. Not like I'm attached to it particularly, but cheesecake. If cheesecake prevents you from fasting, you know, you're supposed to 1 hour fast before Mass. Oh, but this piece of cheesecake, and I'm not going to get another chance to have it because it's right there, and then we got to rush, and I won't have time, so I better have my cheesecake now. So you chose your cheesecake over receiving communion. Or, worse yet, you chose your cheesecake, and I'm still going to receive communion, knowing that I shouldn't. Because there's a church discipline there. That's a bad example because, frankly, most Masses last close to an hour, so all you have to do is really show up 5 or 10 minutes before Mass, and you can probably go to communion a lot of the time. But there are a lot of times that we can have things that in and of themselves are not bad. But we nonetheless, we become, if we never make any sacrifices in our lives, which is part of the reason why things like fasting and little sacrifices here and there are good, if those things start to have power over us, they can prevent us, those things that in and of themselves are okay, can prevent us from doing things that are difficult for God when he asks us to. I'm even trying to think of a better example than cheesecake. Yeah.
Sunday morning sports.
Okay, Sunday morning sports. Okay, fine. Either your children play sports or there's an important football game on, and this one always cracks me up because when you live in New York, especially the closer you are to the city, the funnier it is. I couldn't go to Mass. Why? Because, you know, the game was on, well, wait a minute, Saturday evening at 5, probably Saturday evening at 7, 8 in the morning, 10:30, 12, 5 and 7. The game lasted that entire stretch of time. Oh, this is not the Olympics. Okay, but there's a very classic, it's a classic example. Nothing wrong with going to a football game. Nothing wrong with arranging your schedule even so that you can make sure, you know, it's playoffs or something and you want to watch the Giants. It's fine. But if the decision comes down to the Giants game or going to Mass and receiving God, and we so easily was, oh, God will understand. Yeah, he understands. He understands that you chose something stupid like a football game that you could watch on the recording of anyway. It's not like it even goes anywhere. God understands perfectly well. He understands that you chose football over him. Try doing that to your wife and seeing how, or sorry, you don't have to. Try doing that to your husband and seeing how well that flies. Okay? It's like, sorry. I know that we agreed that we're going to do whatever, but my friend called and I went out to coffee with her. And I know your husbands sometimes do that to you and you hate it, but do it to him and see what his reaction is, okay? Especially do it systematically every Sunday for 16 weeks plus playoffs and see where your marriage ends up. So, the first, like I said, the first degree of humility then is to obey the commandments of God, which it corresponds to the purgative stage of the spiritual life, which is the stage where I realize I need to start giving up things that I am inordinately attached to, and especially I need to start avoiding things that I know are explicitly sinful in order to start trying to do God's will. And St. Ignatius says something that used to shake me up, because I didn't totally understand where he was coming from. What he said is, and this going along with this implies the fact that I would rather die than commit a mortal sin. Now, here's the problem. I know people who still have some habits and occasionally might even slip into a mortal sin, and there are people that are trying to live advanced spiritual lives, but they still, you know, I'm like, holy smokes, death. I don't even know if I would, at this, okay. They've got the fire lit up and the steak is ready to go. Okay, commit a mortal sin or we're going to roast you alive on the spit. I'm like, well, I don't know. Maybe even at this stage of my life, I might be inclined. I mean, so what is St. Ignatius saying? That you will necessarily have the heroism to be a martyr? Not necessarily, but what he's saying is your fundamental disposition. It's kind of like when you go to confession. You tell the priest, in all earnestness, I promise I'm going to do everything I can not to sin again. Tomorrow you might sin again. You might even commit some of the sins that you just confessed. But your disposition in that moment is, I'm not going to sit here and negotiate with sin. Okay, so I think it's something like that. Because otherwise it's like, geez Louise, it's heroic. I mean, it's already, you're already like in the heights of mysticism when you're kind of ready for martyrdom as a rule of thumb. Especially if it's one of those tough martyrdoms. Maybe the bullet in the head, you know, maybe. We might be willing to go there, but some of those medieval ones, forget it. What does this look like for us again? I had something brilliant to say, but I forgot it, so the Holy Spirit is sparing you. The second stage of the spiritual life, this is the one, this is another one that I used to really wrestle with. And when you hear this, it'll be like, wow, this is heavy duty stuff. And it is. It is to be indifferent, basically, to anything that's fun. So to be radically indifferent, you just simply to seek God's will, regardless of what it is. And if God desires for you good health or bad health, wealth or poverty, honors or humiliation, or any number of other icky, yucky things that you don't like, you are indifferent as long as it is God's will. Whatever he chooses for you, it's your only criteria is to say, Lord, whatever most pleases you for me at this moment, that's what I want. I want your will. Now think about that. Let that one sink in for a second. I'm totally indifferent, Lord. If you give me short life or long life, that was another one he threw out there, good health or bad, wealth or poverty, honors or humiliation. How many of us can honestly say, and everyone is here trying to do a weekend retreat because we're the kind of people that pray every day and all that. How many of us can honestly say, whatever God wants, I'm okay with it? That's a heavy lift. We haven't even begun to enter into the second stage of the spiritual life if we're not at least in that conversation. The second stage of the spiritual life is, as we said, the gateway to that, or the passive purifications that I was talking about this morning when I was explaining in the conference on prayer, kind of, you know, when you go through that dryness and nothing seems to work, is like your imagination, and you feel neither inclined to pray, but you also don't feel particularly inclined to the things of the world, and you try to pray and it's just dry and it doesn't seem to work, and whatever you used to do that works so well doesn't work anymore, and you're just in this kind of, you know, horrible feeling state. That's the purification of the senses. That's the gateway into the second stage of the spiritual life, which is where the gateway to contemplative prayer begins. Okay, but Ignatius, that's a heavy lift when he says I'm indifferent to all that stuff. And the corresponding attitude towards sin is, again, death before committing a venial sin. It's no longer even mortal sin. This is venial sin. Again, that was the one that used to get me, because I'm like, holy smokes, I commit venial sins every day. Can I honestly say I'm ready for this? If I, but again, I think the disposition is, it's not the fact that I will never commit a venial sin, or that I would go to the firing line rather than tell a little fib here or there or something like that. That would be a grace that I would pray that God gives me, but I may not be able to bank on that. But again, I think it is the kind of mental disposition that I will not negotiate with sin in my venial sin in my life. I may, out of weakness, fall into it. That's a different thing. But I'm not going to consciously accept and negotiate with venial sin. So that's the distinction that I think needs to make to be made. Otherwise, this feels like it's totally impossible. It's not. There's a difference between being weak and just flat out saying, no, I'm good with that sin. I'm not giving it up. It's just, I like it. It's fun, you know? This is actually where a lot of you are probably wrestling. And again, the whole bit about the radical indifference, I think we're talking about to actually receive that grace is a big grace. But if, on the level of our decisions, on the level of our decisions, whether or not we have the strength always to follow through, on the level of our decisions, am I at the stage where I would say, Lord, whatever you want, whatever you want. If you, this is your plan for me, I'll take it. I need you to give me the strength, because by myself I don't have the strength, but if this is what you want, then when we get to that point, then we're entering into a new stage. There's a qualitative difference. There's a qualitative jump. It's not just more of the same. When you go from the purgative to the illuminative, it's not just that it's like the purgative but and a little bit more. It's like there's a transformation in the approach. And it comes down to passivity or docility. And that's what this is about. The Ignatian indifference, it's about docility. The first one is, I really want to seek to do God's will. I'm going to do whatever I can, which is necessary. But increasingly, we learn that the I am going to do this and I'm going to try is not enough. And God is increasingly, we can start saying, I'm going to make all kinds of little sacrifices and resolutions, and I'm going to, which is proper to the first stages of the spiritual life. The longer you go in the spiritual life, the fewer resolutions you tend to make. But if you're, what happens is, I can do stuff like fasting and cold showers and, giving up certain foods and whatever, mortifying my desire to show off and wearing humble clothing. All of those are good resolutions. God will respect them. They will help you to grow in holiness. But in a certain sense, those are things that you're kind of in control of. You're offering it to God. It's good. You manage it. But docility comes when God throws you something that you totally out of left field, and it's like, wow, he hit me right where I wasn't expecting and where I don't have what it takes to deal with this cross. God knows exactly what you can and cannot do by your own strength, and he knows precisely how to give you something that just totally unexpected, some weak spot that you didn't even know existed. And he's going to say, hey, try this one on for size. Boom. And again, it's not to be cruel. It's so that we can learn to depend on him, because we are forced to at this stage. And he probably won't give you those kind of things so much until he knows that you already are trending in that direction where you want to start just learning how to depend on him. And that's part of the reason why God, quote unquote, treats his saints so meanly. The more open we are to doing his will, the more it seems like he allows sufferings and torment and worldly, from a worldly perspective, it's like some of these saints, it's like, why would you want to be one? It's, if this is what it's going to be like. Okay, well, because what God is doing on the inside is a radical transformation. With that also, even in the midst of suffering, comes an increase in joy and an increase in fulfillment and an increase in so many different interior aspects. Plus, an eternal reward, which is not a small thing, which is completely disproportionate. But even in this life, the rewards that God gives, even though to somebody who hasn't experienced, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but to somebody who passes through his purifications, they say, I would have never chosen that for myself. I didn't want it, I wouldn't have wanted it, but I'm kind of glad he gave it to me. Because he brought me through, and now on the other side of this, I'm now a different person. And that's what it was required. So there's a kind of sobriety to letting God be God. Okay, if you thought that wasn't enough, get ready for number three. Number three sounds very similar to number two, because number two is already total indifference. Whatever God wants. That sounds like it's already the pinnacle. I mean, it's pretty good when you're like, totally God, whatever you want, I choose. And what, and number three, we're not going to tell God what to do. But the difference is, instead of just saying, kind of God, whatever, we're like, if it were up to me, I would choose the humiliation and the poverty and the, you know, the physical suffering and the short life and all those things. Why? Because we're masochistic? No. In order to be more like Christ, who chose those things for himself. In order, this is what Christ chose for himself for a reason. And as part of his mystical body, united to him in baptism, if I want to be like Christ, then he's going to invite me into living his mysteries, the same kind of mysteries that he lived. Again, look at the Blessed Virgin Mary. Look at the way that, look at, in a certain sense, what son would treat his mother that way? Good grief. Look at the stuff that he allowed her to go through, but she wanted it. Not that it was a, you know, barrel of laughs going, watching her son be crucified and all those things, but she wanted, in the sense, to be part of anything, no matter what he did, no matter what he went through, no matter what he experienced, pleasant, not so pleasant, agonizing, whatever. Her only aspiration was absolute perfect union and accompaniment with her son, no matter what, no conditions. And if this is the path that her son chose, and remember, he didn't begin his passion even, you know, on Good Friday, right? He chose to be born into poverty. He chose to be in obscurity and to be humiliated and all kinds of different things for 33 years before leading up to that path. And Mary understood very well, okay, this is, God himself chose this lifestyle, so I'm going to live it, I'm going to embrace it and live it all the way. This is what it looks like when you're living in the unitive path. But once again, when I get there, I'll let you know about it. Ain't there yet, so I can only read about all those other great saints that are there, you know. And here again, it feels like, okay, if the other one was, I would rather die before committing a venial sin, I mean, what in the world is left? Here, the disposition before sin is death before even imperfection. Now, do you even know what the difference between a venial sin and an imperfection is? Okay, an imperfection is something, a venial sin implies you have an action that is bad, but it is not grave matter, or if it is grave matter, I, in and of itself, you know, my freedom was limited, or my conscious choice or whatever was severely limited. Imperfection is something that you're kind of almost not aware you did. It's like when we swear a lot of the times. It's like, dope! There wasn't a whole lot of consciousness there. It came out. It was a bad thing? Sure. Was it probably grave matter? Not likely, unless you're blaspheming God or something. But, you know, it was lacking in gravity and even in consciousness. It just kind of come blurting out. Okay, that would be an imperfection. I'm even trying to imagine what some of the imperfections are. But a lot of the little spontaneous, semi-conscious things that we do that aren't even, they're not even really choices. They're just kind of, they're bad habits that with enough work we will iron them out. But there's not total, a lot of the time, conscious decision. Like I said, using bad language can be an example. If I were to use bad language, because frankly speaking, surprise, surprise, being a priest is not something I do, okay? I will also make a public declaration. I was known to use a salty term or two before I joined the seminary, right? However, I've gone 33 years of living the life that I live. So if I were to come blurt something out, it would probably be pretty conscious. There would be decision by this stage of my life. It would be clearly in the realm of sin. Some sailor blurts something out. I mean, he probably might not even notice he did it, but it's still a bad thing, and it's still something that needs to be worked on. So there's the difference, okay? Alrighty, so I'm gonna try to cruise through the entire Gospel of John's chapter 9 very quickly. One of the funniest, most entertaining gospels or passages in the entire Bible. I would put it in the top five most entertaining things in the entire Bible, is chapter 9 of John, which is the man born blind. Sorry? Oh, I don't know. It probably is. I chose Hosea out of the blue, and we've been reading him, and it didn't occur to me. I probably chose this Sunday's gospel too. So, the man born blind, I'm going to make it work, okay? You maybe didn't reach the heights of the unitive stage or whatever, but I'm going to make it work, okay? Just deal with it. So Jesus is in the temple. He passed by and sees a man born blind from birth. Disciples ask him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither he nor his parents sinned. It is so that the works of God might be made visible through him." Interesting point. What are the works of God that are going to be visible in him? The obvious thing is that God's going to perform a miracle in front of everybody. But I think even more so, the works of God that are about to take place in him, he's gonna go through a radical conversion in about a 30-minute window. But I mean, it's remarkable to see the transformation that takes place in this guy, and he kind of covers the entire arc in, probably a 30-minute time span of time. Then he talks about night is coming when no one can work. So when he said this, he spits on the ground and makes clay with his saliva and smears the clay on the man's eyes. Does that sound vaguely familiar? Okay. Sorry, what are you saying? Genesis. What part of Genesis?
Making Adam out of
Okay, making Adam out of the clay of the earth and breathing into it. And this time, instead of breathing, probably the guy would have preferred he breathed on the dust, but this time he spat on it. God breathed, and from his mouth into the clay, he turns it into something salvific. So there's already and what he's doing is he's communicating, because the gospel writers, when they would reflect back on this, they would take note of these things and put them in there on purpose, because they said, hey, yeah, there is a new creation, a recreation of humanity happening here. And he says, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back able to see. Interesting. Jesus, normally we think the Jesus' normal modus operandi is, do you believe I can do this? Yes, Lord, I believe. Okay, so be it to be done. Your faith has cured you. Here, he spits on the ground, puts mud on this poor guy's eyes. The guy so far didn't ask for it. Didn't seem to show any sign of faith in Jesus or anything. He just says, go wash. And the guy's like, of course, yeah, you just spat all over. And the guy comes back able to see with no apparent act of faith ahead of time. Interesting. So his neighbors and those who had seen him earlier said, isn't this the one who used to sit and beg? Some said it is. Others said, no, he just looks like him. But he himself said, I am. Again. Interesting. He didn't say I am the one or anything. He says I am, which would, how do you pronounce the words I am in Hebrew? Yahweh. So they said to him, how were your eyes opened? Which is a logical thing to ask. He replied, the man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and told me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went there and washed and was able to see. He's beginning his first act of confession of faith. He's not declaring this man is the Son of God or anything, but he's simply stating the truth. And he knows enough about Jesus because it was clearly common knowledge. If you declare belief in Jesus, you will be kicked out of the temple. You'll be busted. So the guy would have known this. And it comes up later. His parents, we know, didn't want to defend their own son because they didn't want to get kicked out of the temple, because then you're excommunicated effectively. It's like a Catholic who's not able to go to the sacraments, okay? But nonetheless, he's already, because he was cured, he's able to say, look, I'm willing to publicly state Jesus cured me. Take that for whatever you want. They said to him, where is he? I don't know. So they brought the one who was blind to the Pharisees. Jesus had made the clay on the Sabbath. The Pharisees asked him. He said he explained the whole thing. The Pharisees' conclusion, this man is not from God because he performs miracles on a Sabbath. No, that's not what they said, but because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a sinful man do such signs? So there was a division. So they said to the blind man again, what do you have to say about him since he opened your eyes? Now, at this point, he's been listening to this whole thing, and clearly he has had time to be reflecting and saying, this has to be a man of God. So he says, he is a prophet. Which, again, very logical conclusion. The man is clearly showing openness to Jesus. Which already, for him to say he is a prophet, in that context, he's setting himself up to get busted. Because they already knew you're not supposed to defend Jesus, not certainly not in the temple. He did things like turn over the money changers and cleanse the temple and call the scribes and Pharisees vipers and whatever else. You don't defend this guy in the seat of their power. So the Jews did not believe. Interesting. They didn't believe that he'd been born blind, so they summoned his parents. They asked him, is this your son who you say was born blind? How does he now see? So right now what we see is he's already gone from through the purgative stage, and he's already beginning the illuminative stage. He's already willing to make sacrifices to defend the name of Jesus. And because he's willing to make those sacrifices in defense of the name of Jesus, Jesus starts enlightening his conscience to where within a few minutes he's confessing that this man is a prophet sent from God. He does works by the power of God, which means that there is a gradual illumination of his conscience taking place, and he's already kind of entering into that second stage. So his parents said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. We do not know how he sees or who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age. They did know how he saw and they did know who did it, so they're lying. Okay, right there. We asked earlier, give me some examples of when we're not even in the first stage of the spiritual life, God or football or whatever. So here his parents know who cured him. They may not know how, but they know who cured him. They don't want to have to deal with it. They say, we don't know. They wimped out. They were not even at that first stage. And in a certain sense, it's understandable because, frankly, like I said, most Catholics would have done the same thing that they did here. It's inconvenient to live my faith in public, so I don't know. Well, I'm convinced myself that I don't really need to go to Mass or whatever the thing is. He can speak for himself. It says, his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone acknowledged him as the Messiah, he would be expelled from the synagogue. So it's a synagogue, not the temple. My mistake. For this reason, his parents said he's of age. Question. Okay, fine. So second time they called the man who had been born blind and said to him, give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner. This is like one of the funniest parts of the whole Bible. So they're like, we know he's a sinner. No, they don't. We want to convince ourselves. We are convinced that he's a sinner would have been a more accurate thing. If he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know is that I was blind and now I see. I mean, have you ever had somebody where it's just the simple, like the faith of children? Sometimes somebody says something so obvious, everyone's raging, rah, rah, during the whole woke thing a few years ago. We had a few of those moments where there were things that were so obvious, and somebody just comes out and says something just like clearly, and you're just like, oh, I guess you can't argue with that. You know who was awesome for that, by the way, was Pope Benedict. There would be these theological arguments, and he would just come out with like some one-liner and just shut down both sides. And it could be because it was so obvious, he would just make it so clear. He would just say, you know, boom. And it was like, oh, I guess I could have thought of that. But he would just put it like with so much clarity. The other person was Mother Teresa. If you see, you know, I remember in that video, Something Beautiful for God. And I think it was in Mexico. She wanted to open up an orphanage and they promised her a property. But of course, some politician was like, well, maybe we'll give her one that's not quite as good and over here. And in the end, she ended up getting both. But you see the answers that they're giving. They're trying to convince her, you know, Mother, like, really, we were thinking over here. It's like, I'll just put it in God's hands. They're like, well, what do you say to that? We're Catholics. we know this man, if he's a sinner, I do not know. The one thing I know is that I was blind and now I see. You can't argue with that. So they said to him, what do they do to you? How do they open your eyes? And this is where he gets fed up. He's already well into the stage of Ignatian indifference at this point because he just doesn't care. He's not looking for the cross yet. He's not saying, please bring upon me persecutions. But he says simply, look, if proclaiming the truth is going to bring me poverty, humiliation, short life, bad health, whatever, all this stuff, I will be completely indifferent because I only want to do God's will. And that's pretty much the state that he's in this moment. What do they do to you? How do you open your eyes? He said to him, I told you already and you didn't listen. Do you want to hear it again? Do you want to be his disciples too? Oh. So this, as my teens would have said a few years ago when I used to be in youth ministry, he's getting spicy at this stage. So they ridiculed him, which is the answer. Whenever evil has no answer to clear patent truth, the only thing left is to insult the person. Since you can't beat the argument, you just insult the person. They ridiculed him and said, you are that man's disciple, which is true. We are disciples of Moses, which wasn't. We know that God spoke to Moses, but we do not know where this one is from. And again, he comes back was something so obvious. That the funny thing about this guy is he didn't even use advanced arguments. He just simply said the simplest, clearest things that they already knew, but they simply did not want to accept it. Any child could have come up with his arguments if he had the guts to do it. This is what's so amazing. You don't know where he's from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if one is devout and does his will, he listens to him. It's unheard of that anyone ever opened the eyes of a person born blind. If he were not from God, he would not be able to do anything. So again, they can't argue with his arguments, so they insult him. You're born totally in sin, and you're trying to teach us, so they throw him out. And it concludes with, at least analogously, him entering into the third stage, the unitive stage. When Jesus heard, as I would say in Spanish, que este si tiene pantalones. Do anyone understand? No, okay. When Jesus heard that this guy's got guts, okay, this guy's got character to him, and that they had thrown him out, he found him. Jesus goes looking for him. It's something beautiful. Jesus sometimes allows us to be set up, so to quote unquote, to fail, right? He allows us to face the music and to go through difficult things. And Jesus could have stopped it. He could have just stepped in and said, hey, I did. What do you got to say about it? And they wouldn't have been able to because they never could. But he let this guy go through all this because he knew that he was leading him on a path. And then Jesus seeks him out, finds him and says, do you believe in the Son of Man? What a weird title. The Son of Man. Jesus used that regularly about himself. It comes from the book of Daniel primarily. And it was interesting because I saw one like the Son of Man coming in the clouds. Well, that came later. That was in Revelation. But Daniel has a vision of one like the Son of Man, who is clearly God, but nonetheless with this kind of human form. So Jesus saying, do you believe in the Son of Man, the God-man? The guy says, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? So really at this stage, he's already saying, I'll believe anything you tell me. Just tell me what I'm supposed to believe. It's very similar to Mary's fiat. When, how can this be because I do not know man? What's she saying? She's like, look, I believe what you're saying. I just need enough information to work with here. Give me what I need to give God a total yes. The guy is doing something very similar. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir, that I can believe in him? Give me the information I need, and I will believe whatever you tell me at this stage. I have bought into you. Which requires God's grace. It wasn't only his, human stubbornness and everything at play. You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he. He said, I do believe, Lord, and he worshipped him. Wow. Remember, these are strict monotheists. Inconceivable that a Jew would worship a man. And somehow, the only way you can explain it, this is like St. Peter, when flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. This is one of those moments. There's no way he arrived to this stage unless God had taken him through the meat grinder and purified him, and he had to make multiple acts of faith along the way, and God just kept bringing him through more and more and more to bring him to this point. At this stage, why do I say this is the unitive stage, or the unitive where you're seeking whatever it takes to be more like Christ? He's worshiping Christ, knowing the consequences of that. And his only aspiration is, Lord, I want to be with you. I want to be like you. Wherever that ends up leading me. My only desire at this stage is to be your disciple. He doesn't have a full catechism or catechesis like the 12 apostles and the Blessed Mother and so many other people. His knowledge is limited, but he's already arrived in a short period of time to the stage where it's like, my life only makes sense with you. Kind of like a Mary Magdalene moment. Mary Magdalene also went through one of those processes that probably was more drawn out than this guy's.